Jason's going to do a mini lesson for us on
evolution and creation.
Evolution and creation. There we go.
15 minutes. Okay. I'm starting with 10. I don't know if I'll fill it or leave more space in it.
Fine.
Okay. What is evolution? Tell me. What is it?
It's the theory, false theory, that humans originated from, like, animals, and they moved themselves up and changed a lot over a lot of years.
Yeah. And they also believe that, well, most evolutionists believe that it came originally from the Big Bang. So, evolution. It's believing that kinds change into different kinds, like a monkey into a man, for example. Also the Big Bang.
The word evolution can just be used just to mean change, to evolve, but yes, we're
right.
Talking specifically about
it. I forgot which type of evolution that's called. The only evolution that is observable, actually, is
Pokemon.
Yeah. I forgot what it was called, but it's where you observe the evidence, you observe the change, and that's just from species to species.
Within a species, yeah.
Yeah. Charles Darwin had the finches. He went to the Galapagos Islands. Who here has learned about that? Cool. So they all had different beaks and stuff. There's like different ones. And he based his belief in evolution off of the finches. But the problem is, the evolution that he believed in was a change in kinds, which is his conclusion that he drew in his mind was that kind of humans came from ultimately nothing. They came from very small things to humans, like apes and then humans, etc. This is just change in species. So this is all the same kind. This is all the same kind of animal. They're all still birds. They're just different types of birds. So that's not evolution. Well, that's one type of evolution, the only observable type of evolution. But that's not what we're talking about. So that is not actual evidence of what he claims evolution is, of the evolution he believes in. There's a guy named Ernst Haeckel. How many people have seen these embryos before? These examples of the embryo, and then they're going down into different animals. This kind of shows that they're all similar. He's trying to prove that they're all from a common ancestor. It didn't print right, but they're all very similar embryos. It turns out he was...
Unless you need it.
He was convicted of fraud for drawing those because they're actually false and they don't look that similar in real life. He was convicted of fraud by his own university. Based off of this, he read Darwin's book, and that's how he came up with it. There was no proof of Darwin's theory for like 9 years, and then he came up with that, just to help Darwin out, I guess. And he converted a lot of Germany to believe in evolution just because of that one dude. He said like the embryos have gills, which is false. It looks like they have gills, but they don't. Those are actually bones and glands that form later. So evolutionary scientists use a thing to tell the age of fossils in animals and stuff. They use a thing called radiometric dating. Very simply put, they use a device called a Geiger counter, and they animals. Their theory is that animals take in carbon from the atmosphere. They either breathe it in or eat it or something. Then once they die, they obviously stop taking it in. So they can measure how, with that little device, they measure the radiation of that the carbon is bringing off, like based on how much radiation, because once it stops, it there's a certain amount of carbon that it has. So you can measure it from that. But this is all, this is, they have like a chart where like it makes, the thing makes a clicky sound, and however many clicks per minute, that's how old the animal or fossil is supposedly. This is the method used, the type of science this is that they use to determine the age is called empirical science, which is observable science, so stuff that you can test and measure without assuming anything from the past. It's just what's there and you can examine. So I'm stealing this analogy from someone else, but let's say you walk into a room and there's a lit candle. How long was the candle lit? We don't know.
I don't know, Jason. How long was it lit?
Well, we can use empirical science to measure. Let's say we measure the height. That's like 5 inches or something. Okay, still doesn't help when we know the candle was lit. We can find out the rate of how long it was burning. So we can sit here and wait till the candle dies down. Let's say it burns at an inch per hour. That still doesn't tell us how long the candle has been lit and when it was lit. In order to draw a conclusion to when the candle was lit, we would have to assume, which is not empirical science, we would have to assume that the candle was this long when it started, and that it stayed burning at the same rate the whole time, which we don't know if that's true or not. So that's the same method that the fossil people use to measure the age of the fossils. It's not observable, it's a guess. The bottom line is it's a guess because they have assumptions to draw their conclusions of the age of the fossils and stuff.
Could it be accurate?
I don't know. Maybe I'll remember something along the lesson. Maybe okay. I could answer that later. I don't know. Okay, and the Big Bang. So we did that evolution stuff. Now we're doing the Big Bang, which is very brief. So they believe that a lot of Big Bangists believe that it started with nothing, and then it was all the particles and stuff in all the mass in the universe was spinning really, really fast, and then eventually it all just spread out and exploded. So I'm the universe at the beginning. I'm going to spin clockwise. They believe it was spinning one way when it exploded. I'm going to spin clockwise. Pay attention to which way the marker is spinning when I let go. Okay? If I spin the same way or the opposite way. Which way did it spin? Same way I was. So, either way, really. All the planets and stars and stuff would be spinning the same way it came out, but there's actually a couple planets. I think it's Venus and Uranus and a bunch of other moons that are spinning the opposite direction of the rest of the planets. So that theory kind of doesn't work. Okay. Now we're going to do some creation stuff with our Bibles. So get a Bible if you have one. Just a quick question. Where do you think we'll start if we're talking about the beginning?
Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis 1:1 is where we'll start.
In the beginning. Yes.
Okay, Genesis 1:1. Okay, just one verse at a time. Actually, 1 and 2. Verses 1 and 2, then stop.
in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth.
And the earth was without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters.
So, I could be wrong. I think this is assuming that the earth was water in the beginning. Not before it wasn't there, but it was water. So, water planet. Okay, you can read, you can proceed where you were and read 3 through 5.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, and it was good. And God decided the light from, God divided the light from the darkness.
God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
So what's the light? The big light of the earth.
The sun.
And
you can keep going now, starting at verse 6. I'll tell you when to stop.
And God said, let there be light in the midst of the water, and let it divide the waters from the water.
And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so.
And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. So, there's a firmament. What's a firmament? Not in this case.
A barrier.
Yes. It's a...
That's a good word for it.
Yeah. The firmament is a separation. Well, yeah, it's a barrier. So it says he made a firmament in the midst of the waters to divide the waters from the waters. Started out with a water planet, and then he divided the waters, separated them from each other.
So how do you do that?
Well,
think about it. How did he separate water from the waters?
He put
the divider.
What kind of divider?
He put a firmament in the midst of the waters.
Well.
So verse 8.
Right?
Yeah, verse 8.
Because, like, he split the sea. He split the water.
No, he's not split it. That way, splitting it it's like an onion, layers of an onion.
Oh.
A firmament between, right? So the air, and what kind of water is in the sky? Lots of it, right? So it's dividing it like an onion. Different than you think with land. Because the land comes eventually.
Eli, can you read verse number 8?
And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day.
So first of all, he called the firmament heaven. The word heaven in this case means sky. So he called it sky. That's what the firmament is. And then it said...
There you go.
It said, and the evening and the morning were the second day. So he's saying the evening and the morning, that's one day. So some people think maybe God's days are millions of years long each. No. Because it says, well, according to the Bible, it says that it's just the day with the sun. Cameron, can you start at verse 9?
And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so.
Keep going.
And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas, and God saw that it was good.
Keep going.
And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit yielding fruit after his kind. The seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so.
And the earth brought forth grass, and herb yielding seed, and was kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good.
There was evening, and there was morning, the third day.
Boom. So, evening and morning again, that's another day. Verse 9 and 10 is, he made the oceans gather together, make the water gather together, make the oceans, and the earth came up, too. And 11 and 12, it said, let earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, those seed was it in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. So God's okay with kinds to the same kind, whether there's variations between the kinds or not. It's the same kind. It's the same kind of plant. And verse 24 and 25, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, the beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. So this is, you can't, from the way I see it, you can't logically be an evolutionist and a Christian at the same time. If you do, I don't know if that's accurate according to the Bible. Okay. Let's go to Psalm 24. Actually, I'm going to pick the individual people. Evan, read Psalm 24, 1 through 2. And Eli, read Psalm 33, 7. And Sierra, read Genesis 7, 11. Yes. 24, 1 through 2.
The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. For he hath founded it upon the seas, and established it upon the floods.
So, we got that part. He founded it upon the seas. And that means the, yeah. Okay. Eli, read your verse, please.
He gathered the waters of the sea together as a heap. He layeth up the depth in storehouses.
So there's a bunch of storehouses of water. This is the earth's core. There's a bunch of storehouses of water, according to the Bible. Sierra, can you read your verse, please?
In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth. The floodgates of the heavens were opened.
So this is the flood, Noah's flood. Can you read that again?
He liked the way you did it.
In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened.
So, this is ground level. These are where the things are. There's a theory about how the flood came. It's called the hydroplate theory. It burst up. The water burst up like almost 20 miles up into the air. And that was how a great amount of the flood came. And also it says the heavens opened up. Could be the clouds rained. Or it could have literally been the heavens that opened up and poured out a ton of water on the earth. The flood caused a lot of things that evolutionists try and use as their evidence for evolution. Like a bunch of mountains. This formed a bunch of mountains and rivers. And one of the things it formed particularly was the Grand Canyon, most likely. Evolutionary scientists believe that the Colorado River formed the Grand Canyon. The Colorado River is 2,800 feet above sea level, and the Grand Canyon is 6,900 to 8,500 feet above sea level. Which ways do water flow? Do rivers flow?
Down.
Downhill, not uphill. This is, I think it's the floor of the Grand Canyon is that high, not even the top of it. So that's kind of out the window, scientifically. It's called, the thing in the Grand Canyon is called the Kiabab Uplift. Also, scientists believe that there's that the layers of the Grand Canyon and all the other layers on the Earth are millions of years old. Yet there are no erosion marks in the Grand Canyon at all, in the layers. You'd think after millions of years it would rain once or twice. But there are no erosion marks in any of the layers. They found petrified trees through layers of the ground. If there was layers of the ground and you stuck a tree in there in the Grand Canyon, that's how they found it. It seems more logical to me if a flood came and did all that all at once, poured dirt on top of it, rather than a tree becoming petrified and then millions of years of layers toppled over it while the tree did not rot. It's not very logical. Also, if you take a thing of dirt in water and you shake it and you let it sit, it just settles in layers. That's how it looks.
All too logical.
They also found petrified trees upside down in the layers. So, how'd that happen? Yeah. There's a lizard-like bird that's extinct called the Archaeopteryx. It's supposedly 65 million years old, based on the carbon dating that doesn't work. It was found in deeper layers of the ground. The layers of the ground that it was found in were supposedly 180 million years old. But the bird's only supposed to be 65 million years old. How did that happen? Here's the ground level. Here's 180 million years ago. That's when that was. And then this formed, and this is 65 million years ago. This is how old the bird's supposed to be. They found it down here. All right, let's go to Genesis 3. We'll read verses 1 through 7, starting with Audrey, when you guys are ready.
Now the spirit was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath made. And he said unto God said, Ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden.
This is the devil we're talking about, serpent.
And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden.
You want me to read?
Yeah.
But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, Ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die.
And the serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall surely not die.
For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil.
And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree to be desired to make one wise, She took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat.
Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and covered themselves.
So the devil, the serpent, basically my point for these verses is the devil is a trickster. He's very subtle and sneaky and not good. He talked to Eve. Using just his words, he caused her to stumble. There's a very subtle thing in here. I don't know if some would even consider it to be a thing, but now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, Ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Already he's trying to deceive her. He actually said God instead of the Lord God, which is, if I'm not mistaken, that's how the rest of the Bible from the beginning on referred to God, as the Lord God, not just God. And I think he's just trying to make it not sound as bad. That's how the devil works. He'll do anything to make things sound true, sound not as bad, things like that. And sometimes it's not even in the form of his voice. If you talk about nowadays, it sounds like your voice in your head. It's just your thoughts. But they're tempting, and he works through those if you let him. He's very subtle. And in verse 4 he said, you won't surely die if you eat of the tree. At first I thought this was like, okay, he's right, he's just trying to deceive her. No, that's a flat-out lie. She died eventually and spiritually that day. Satan gets in a lot of people's lives, and like the thing of evolution, like it doesn't seem like a big deal. It's just a belief, whether either you believe it or not, but it can lead to anything that's not truthful can lead to something bad. These are extreme examples, but like Haeckel used that chart of the embryos, and he made like a lot of Germany just believe in evolution. Because he spread it just from one person, he spread that. These are extreme examples, like I said, but Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot, all those mass murderers were all evolutionists, actually, because they don't believe there's any value to life. Because we're all just came from nothing, literally. So what's the point? In John it says, like, the devil comes to steal, kill, and destroy. There's also somewhere in the Bible it says, the devil looks like an angel of light, but that's not the case. He looks like an angel of light. He's so deceitful. I have a couple verses on my phone. Two verses. Job 22:21-22. You don't have to flip there. Submit to God and peace. Submit to God and be at peace with Him. In this way, prosperity will come to you. Accept instruction from His mouth and lay up His words in your heart. Submit to God and be at peace with Him. So he's saying, if you submit to God, you will be at peace with Him. And prosperity will come to you. In verse 22, it says, accept instruction from His mouth and lay up His words in your heart. Where is God's instruction? Yes. And also in your conscience and stuff. But yes, the Bible is the big deal. Lay up His words in your heart. If you just do that and try and do that consistently, submit to God. You can't do anything by you trying. If you submit to God and do those things, if you hide His word in your heart, you will know the truth. You'll be able to learn and discover things like whether evolution is true or not. and different things like that, things that are much more important than that, too. I think that's all I have. That's it.
Encore.
Sorry.
Good job. All right, let's all turn over. We're going to finish up tonight here in our book where we've been going, Book of Ezekiel. And in Ezekiel, we're going to go over quickly the main points of Ezekiel. Who's Ezekiel?
He was a prophet of God who was taken prisoner by Nebuchadnezzar and lived by the Kibar in Babylon.
There we go. Okay, and tell me what his main message is. Tell me what his main message is. Almost everything he did pointed to one big main thing that was going to happen. What city was something big going to happen to?
Jerusalem.
There we go. And what's going to happen? It's a siege, going to be destroyed. And there's all sorts of things, right? He makes a little, he plays army and sets up the siege, right? He cuts his hair off and some in the wind and this, and puts a little bit in the lapel of his cloak because God saves a tiny bit, right? God always protects a tiny bit. And what is that tiny bit?
Remnant.
The remnant, right? So that's an important piece. God protects the remnant. So his main big lesson for everyone is all about Jerusalem. It's all about the southern kingdom of Judah has turned away from God. And you remember, I hope you remember, that all the big angels were there, all the crazy weird angels with wheels and heads of animals and all the stuff, right? And on top of them with the big dome, and on top of the dome was...
Throne with Jesus.
A throne with Jesus on it, right? And he is inside. Remember, they go through the temple, and he has this vision of going through the temple, and he goes through the walls, and he looks through the walls, and he finds all these evil things that are happening, all mostly to do with them following following idols, right? All of that has to do. And when God says, finally, I'm going to leave you, remember, he come up on the threshold, right? Which the threshold is the edge of the door. He comes up and he stands on the threshold. And then God himself is standing on the threshold with the angels and all the big entourage with him. And he leaves the temple. And the leaving of the temple means what?
He's what?
He's not there.
Hey! Even though this was the most beautiful temple you have ever seen. And it was the most beautiful temple. Built by, anybody know?
Moses.
King?
David.
Solomon. Okay. You really tried? You were close. But not me. Okay. King Solomon builds this beautiful temple. It is the most incredible thing on the face of the earth. And it is going to be destroyed. And they are going to wipe it out. Not just come in and take the people out. They are going to wipe it out. They are going to burn it. Burn every piece of it that they can. Because there's wood all throughout it. Stone all on the outside. Built with beautiful cedar trees throughout, okay? Probably some of the largest, finest timber man has ever seen. Monster stones
overlaid with gold and a lot of different pieces and parts. Just incredible building with many other small buildings and outer courts and all kinds of stuff. Okay, this is beautiful. It is thought that this building, in today's money, or any age's money, was probably the most expensive building ever to have been built in mankind's time on Earth. Okay? Block for block, whatever it is, you can translate it to today's money or ancient money or whatever you want. Most expensive, most resources put into it ever for any building. Way more than skyscrapers, way more than all kinds of things that we've ever built. Okay? Impressive building. Way impressive. Okay? And again, everything built off-site and come and put together without the use of a hammer or a chisel. Okay? Without the use of a saw, there was to be no sound on the work site. Silent. Done to respect God. So add that to on top of it, shipping everything up and down, okay, from off-site. And if you're off an eighth of an inch with your chisel, sorry, send it back. Don't chip it off here, send it back. We don't use hammers and chisels here, okay? Incredible building. It was the most magnificent thing in Jerusalem, and everyone loved it. Everybody thought it was fantastic. It was the pride and joy of every Israelite. Look at our temple. Do you see what our God is? Look at our temple. And eventually, it just became, instead of, do you see what our God is, just look at our temple. Look at it. Look how beautiful it is. Look how big it is. Look how amazing it is. Okay? Incredible. It's an incredible thing. But it's going to be destroyed. Totally destroyed. And Ezekiel's got a very special sign. You know how he had some very strange things? He ate the scroll at the beginning, right? And it was all full of sadness and sorrow and terrible things. Well, here's a really sad, sorrowful thing that happens to him. One morning he wakes up. And God says to him, your wife is going to die. Okay? But you cannot be sad when she dies. You can't mourn. You cannot do the normal things that as an Israelite you would do. You are not allowed. They had special bread they ate for funeral type things. Bread of man, it was called, or sorrowful bread, okay? Special bread, special things they did, special clothes they wore. You're not allowed to do any of that. So let's go to Ezekiel chapter number 24. Ezekiel chapter 24. Verse number 15. Let's go this way. 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. And we'll keep going until I...
Also the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with this girl.
So the girl that you love, I'm taking her away like that.
Yet neither shalt thou mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down.
17.
Forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead. Bind the tire of thy head upon thee, and put on thy shoes upon thy feet, and cover not thy lips, and eat not the bread of men.
So I spoke to the people in the morning, and in the evening my wife died. Next morning I did as I had been commanded.
Okay. Let's stop there for a second. Not allowed to do anything. You're supposed to look just like you normally do any other day. God spoke to him that morning, and that night his wife died. Poof, just like that. I tell you, this guy has had such a terrible life. First, I mean, he's a captive. He doesn't even live in his own country, much less But all of the sad things, he's not only is he a captive, but he knows the future of the city and the country that he lived in and how it's not a good future. Even what's left, even the hopes and dreams of, hey, maybe I'll return there someday. Maybe we'll rebuild. Maybe we'll get back. Those seem to be dashed every day. Smash, smash, smash. It's gone. Okay. Take up where we left off, please.
And the people said unto me, wilt thou not tell us what these things are to us, that thou doest so?
Then I answered them, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying,
speak unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will profane mine sanctuary,
excellency
of your strength, the desire of your eyes, and that which your soul pitteth, and your sons and your daughters, then ye have left shall fall by the sword.
Okay, here's what he says. Just like Ezekiel's wife. Because they see his wife die. And they see him the very next morning after his wife dies that night. They all know she dies. They see him the very next morning get up, put his hat on, put his cloak on, go out for normal business just like he did every other day. And they're like, his wife just died yesterday. Don't you think that's a little strange? Shouldn't he be mourning? Shouldn't he be doing all the things we always do? And of course, now they know, right? Ask him, what's up with you, Ezekiel? Because there's always something weird going on with you, right? So they ask him, and he said, this is what God said. Just like my greatest love, the desire of mine eyes was taken from me and dashed away like that and gone, I'm not allowed to mourn for her. Just like that, Israel and the great temple, and all the glory that you think of Israel as for you, the desire of your eyes, the strength of your country, the biggest, most impressive city that you have, it'll be gone. And you will not mourn. You'll not be able to. It'll be all gone. You'll be beyond it. You'll just have to go on. All right? And here's the thing. Don't mourn anyways, because you didn't care about me when I was there. Because I was the important part of that temple and that city. God says, when I was there, you didn't care about me. So you're not going to mourn. When that temple gets crushed to the ground, it won't matter. All right? Bring one more sad thing. Now, we're going to flip gears because in Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, he actually does more than talk about the city of Jerusalem and Israel. Much of his life was centered around that, but he has some other different things. We have two cities. The city of Tyre, T-Y-R-E, okay? And the city of Sidon, or in sometimes older English, Zidon, okay? Sidon, same place. So if you were to go on our infamous map, who doesn't love the map, right?
I definitely love the map a lot.
Good. On the Mediterranean Sea here, down along the coast, there were two cities right on the coast. Sidon was there and Tyre were there. They were kind of sister cities, I would call them. They were very close together. In the ancient world, big shipping ports, big, important business cities. Now, why? Why are they important? Where are they located?
Oh, next to the sea.
Next to the sea, where all the people do their business, right? They go, come in, and they go out, and they come in, and they go out. There are other islands, bigger islands. What's there? Cyprus and Crete and different things. And eventually you get up into Greece and the boot, right? Italy, that's a terrible boot, but okay, you got it. And Sicily's a little island out there. Lots of little islands in the sea, and there are several of them dotted along the coast, too, okay? But these cities were major important cities. And apparently, being major and important, they began to think of themselves as major and important. And God says to them, particularly to Tyre, but to both of them, you have lifted yourself up and claimed that you are the most important thing in this world. You've claimed yourself. You want to be God. You want to be more important to everybody than I am. And for that, I'm against you. Now, when God says he's against you, that's a big X, a big red mark you don't want to have there, because God is sure and complete in all the things he does. If he is forgiving you and he is for you, he is sure and complete in forgiving you. And that's the good side. We want to be on that side, right? We want to be believing in God, being on that side. When he says, I'm against you, watch out. Tyre and Sidon are given their future in the book of Ezekiel. Both of these little cities. Now, they're wrapped up in just about the same time period. So if we were to look at a time period, Ezekiel roughly, and this is putting together dates where Ezekiel comes in, around 592 to 570. Okay? Somewhere around in there. And that's B.C. Which means around 600 years before Christ was born. This is when Ezekiel is giving this prophecy. Okay? Roughly around there. After this is written in the books of history, as things are collected in the ancient books of history, after this book is written, things begin to happen to Tyre. Okay? It's a while longer in history before things happen to Sidon, but Tyre is about 3 years after he writes this book. They start to see the beginning of what happens. Okay? And this is corroborated, or this is put together and understood by not only Bible historical folks, but historians that didn't believe in God. But they were writing down the history of the world and saying, this is what's happened, this is what happened, this is what happened. Okay? So if we go to the book of Ezekiel, chapter number 26, we're going to pick out a couple things here. Chapter 26, we're going to pick out what happens. I'm going to give you a verse, and you're going to read it, and you're going to tell me something that happens out of it. Okay? Chapter 26, verse number 3. Where do we leave off? Back to you. Okay.
Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Tyrus, and will cause many nations to come up against thee, as the sea causes his waves to come up.
Okay. What's happening? God's against him. And what's he going to do?
So, attacked by other nations.
Yeah.
Okay, how many?
A lot.
Many. And what's it going to be like?
Like when the waves hit, like the shore.
Like waves of sea. So, how would you describe the waves of the sea? Big crash or
bam.
Just
bam.
Keep coming, bam. Keep coming, keep bam. Coming, keep bam. Coming, bam. And keep bam. Coming, bam. And coming, bam. Right? And that's how sand really is formed, or that's how things are pounded out, right? They continue to be pounded until there's nothing left, right? Or until they're pounded into dust or grass or powder or sand, okay? Makes it really smooth. All right, verse number 4.
And they shall destroy the walls of Tyrus and break down their towers. I will also take her dust from her and make her like the top of the tower.
Okay, we got a few of them in there.
Decimated.
You're gonna like break down the towers.
Break down towers and
destroy the walls.
And walls, okay.
And then you're gonna scrape the top, like the top of the rock.
Scrape like top of rock. Okay? Alright. So everybody having the picture in their mind what that is? If you were to take a big rock, dump a bunch of little rocks on it, and you said, this is all gone. Scrape Scrape it off, just flat. Okay? That's what God says, I'm going to do that to you. It's bad news already, okay? We'll find out. Okay, verse number 5.
Shall be a place for the spreading of nets in the midst of the sea. For I have spoken it, saith the Lord God, and it shall become a spoil to the nations.
Okay, so what do you got?
Fishing.
It's essentially going to be a fishing, we'll call it rest stop, okay? Where they're going to come out, spread their nets, and dry them out, pick all the little fish guts out of them, okay? Because it's right on the Mediterranean Sea, right? Pick all the fish guts out and chuck them off, and that's what it's going to be. Okay.
And your settlements on the mainland will be ravaged by the sword, and they will know that I am the Lord.
Okay. So, mainland, and this is important, mainland ravaged by sword. Okay? You're going to know that I am God. That's what he's saying. You're going to know that I am God. So we're going to skip down to verse number 12, because this section talks about the king of Tyrus and how he is much like the sin of the devil. And it actually makes a comparison of the sin of the devil. And what sin was the devil's sin?
Ego.
Ego, pride, right? And that's the very same thing. He said, you guys are doing the same thing. Okay, I want to be God. I'm most important. Okay, verse 12.
And they shall make a spoil of thy riches, and make a prey of thy merchandise, and they shall break down thy walls, and destroy thy pleasant houses, and they shall lay thy stones, thy stones and thy timber and thy dust in the midst of the water.
Okay, so lots of different things in there, but stuff that's not repeated.
Take all their stuff.
Take stuff.
Get rich.
Get rich. And then one more piece at the end. That's an important piece.
Hey, chuck everything in the water.
Chuck it in the water.
Water.
Into water. Okay, we got one more. Verse number 14. Okay, we got one more. Built.
No more.
No more. Okay, and then, so as time progresses on these waves of the sea, right, because they're coming in, many people will come, waves of the sea, eventually you get to a place where they will be built no more, and in the end of verse 21, we skip down to the very end of this passage, it says, never be found again. Okay, basically the city is never found again, built no more. At this point, the ancient city of Tyre will be gone. Scraped off like a rock. Thrown into the sea. Smashed down. So, 3 years later, after he makes this prophecy, this is what happens. Here's the story. King Nebuchadnezzar, who is famous for conquering much of the world, right? He likes to break down little cities and he likes a challenge. He decides he's going to take over Tyre. Now, Tyre is that port city right on the edge of the water. And so he comes up to the gates of the city, which are surrounding all the mainland parts and pieces. And of course, there's still a shipping port. It goes out, but he brings an army, not a navy. So he comes up, and how does he get into the city? Well, they're not going to just let him in with an army, right?
Battering rams.
Well, before he does battering rams, he's going to do something else. No missiles, no, not yet. How do we break down a city if we can't get in the wall?
Oh, a siege!
A siege! We learned this, right? We have a siege. Do you know how long he has a siege on Tyre?
7 years.
13 years.
Oh, that's like a lot of my life.
A lot of your life.
My whole life.
Right. He is a very dedicated to destroying this city of Tyre. He brings his army, and for 13 years they camp out. Not his entire army, obviously. But they want Tyre gone. Why does he even care? right? That much? You're going to commit your army for 13 years? So they do. And finally, after 13 years, they figure people have been destroyed enough or taken out enough, and they've stopped enough things. They break through the front walls, and as they break through the front walls, the city is almost empty.
They left in the water.
They left in the water for the past 13 years. They've been slowly rowing out to an island half a mile off the coast.
Half a mile.
Were they bringing a city there?
They built an entire city on the rock half a mile off the coast.
Oh, nice.
Okay? Sneaking out, piece by piece, however they needed to, and they built a strong city of Tyre. Okay, so they had 13 years to do it, right? Out on there. So essentially, then he comes in and he's angry, destroys what's there, but he has no navy. Right? So he pretty much destroys what is there, and the city is just toppled over. They pretty much just destroy it all, and he's angry. He takes what he can. He takes the stuff out, all the riches that he can gather out of there, and they've escaped with their lives, and they're surviving, but he takes everything out. Fast forward a little while, and along comes and Tyre grows, and they defy God. Ha-ha! We'll show you. We'll show you what happens. Along comes Alexander the Great, about 200 years later, okay? And Alexander the Great does an amazing thing. In 333, he takes all the rubble of the city on the mainland, destroys whatever's left, because they've rebuilt quite a bit by then. He destroys all the rubble of the city, destroys everything, kills everybody on the city, and he takes all of the city and pushes it out into the ocean. And he builds a walkway for his army. I don't need a navy. He builds a 200-foot wide walkway a half mile out into the water while the people in Tyre are just watching him. He builds towers on it. He builds, I don't know if they were catapult type things, but they were war engines, they called them, okay, to destroy the city. Because Alexander the Great does things very well when he does it. And he says, I want that. We're going to take it. And so they do. The army builds a road a half a mile long in the ocean, 200 feet wide. And they march the entire army out there. But they know that's not going to be enough. So meanwhile, Alexander the Great, for about 7 months, as he has built this thing out there, and he has created a place where they have now nearly surrounded this city in the middle of the water, he has essentially almost no navy. And he knows it. And so he calls on all of his buddies, or all the people who are scared to death of him. You see, Tyre has defied him. And he said, basically, I'm coming down. I'm Alexander the Great, and I'm going to take your city. And I'm taking them all. So if you'll open your gates kindly for me, things will go a little better for you. And if you don't, you'll wish you had opened your gates for me. That's what he says. So as he builds this causeway way out into the ocean, he marches his army out there. He calls upon ships from all over the world. From Sidon, their neighbor, from Aretas, from Byblis, from Rhodes, from Soli and Malus and Lycia, and where else? Macedon, and 120 ships come from Cyprus. So over 200 ships end up surrounding them, and then they march into the city. They destroy it and push it all, what's left, out into the ocean. So today, if you go to the city of ancient Tyre, it is flat. You'll see a couple columns here and there. You'll see one arch that they took and rebuilt an arch saying, hey, this was the ancient arch, which was just rocks. And all the rest of the rocks were out in the ocean. Still there. And guess what you find on the big flat rock? Fishing nets. Because the fisherman said, hey, it It's a great big wide open rock. I can go out there, pull my nets out, stretch them all out. Doesn't bother anybody. Pick all the fish guts off them, clean them up, repair them, and be ready for fishing. It has been used as this. They've tried to rebuild multiple times, and they've rebuilt parts of the city. And they'll say there is a city of Tyre, but it's all around the ancient city of Tyre. Ancient city of Tyre still lays ruins. Flat. You look at it, it's just nothing. Nothing there. Just some rock, really. Because God's Him going to do it. You cannot defy what God is doing. And this is the thing, when God has a plan, He does it completely. He does it totally. Alright? Now Sidon was their sister city. Of course, they sent a few ships too, to, maybe they weren't so friendly as sisters. Sidon has much a long story too, not quite as many details in it, but essentially in chapter number 28, we're not going to go there now, but chapter 28, verse 22, 23, it talks about it saying, your city, I'm against you, Sidon, your city will have bloodshed in great amounts, and the blood will run in the streets. You're going to see this. You're going to see it again and again and again. Okay? And wave after wave comes to Sidon. The biggest wave begins in 351. The king of Persia comes down through to take over the city of Sidon. Okay? And they hold out for a while. And the king of Persia keeps attacking the city of Sidon. And attacking him, and attacking him, and attacking him. And they hold up, and they do pretty good. Until one day they find out that their king, the king of Sidon, betrays them to the king of Persia so that he can get a free ride out. Tells them their secrets, tells them a way in, unlocks the gate, whatever he needs to do. The people all find out. And they know that the king of Persia will destroy them. But before he destroys them, he will torture them personally. Probably sell many as slaves. Do whatever he feels like with it. He is merciless. And so rather than undergo the terrible things that will happen to the king of Persia, they lock all their own doors. And from the inside, 40,000 people set their houses on fire and burn themselves to death. The whole city wipes himself out from the inside out. You'd never think it would ever get to that, right? But God knows the circumstances that got these people here. God knows what will happen. He sees the future. He knows the fullness of things. And God's completeness says, look, I know accurately 100% what will happen. So you can choose to believe me or choose not to believe me. All right? Just like Jason says, there's stuff that doesn't even make sense when you're looking at evolution. You're looking at these trees that are upside down and the rocks, how they didn't rot for a million years while dirt came on. Well, that doesn't even make sense. But God knows how it works. He knows how to put it together. He understands it. And what God's word says is true. Whether you like it or don't like it, it doesn't really matter. I'm not here to teach you parts that I like. I'm here to teach you parts, all of it. Anything that I can teach you. There's stuff that I have to go home and say, boy, I got to change my heart about this. I got to change what I think about this. I got to watch myself. But it doesn't mean I can't teach it. I got to teach it. That's what I'm here to do. Okay, so understand God is using Ezekiel also for talking about these other cities. City of Tyre, the city of Sidon, he uses some other ones, he talks about them, and it shows perfect accuracy, 100% accuracy of biblical prophecy, more than any other prophet. Okay, shows accuracy. You look at any other modern prophet, and if they have 50, 60% accuracy, people say, oh, that's awesome. Who cares? If you don't have 100% accuracy, throw it out the window. Because you can guess 50% of the time. You can't guess 100% of the time. Okay? But you can guess and be right 50% of the time. But when God puts it down, it is right. It is perfect. It is clear. And it's accurate. Okay? So understand this. That's good for the people who know God. And that's why we do these things and learn from these things. Not so good for Israel. Okay? Not so good for Judah at that point. Ezekiel's message was pretty tough on them. But always remember, he will reserve the remnant. That's his promise. Because he made a promise decades, or generations, I'll say, before to David. He made a promise generations before to Abraham. I will keep your people. I will make them like the sands of the sea. I will make them like the stars in the sky. David, you will have someone in your family on the throne forever. So he makes the promise, and he keeps it forever. God makes a promise, it's good. And that's what faith is belief that when God says something, it's true, it's right, it's accurate, and it will happen. That's one of the good lessons out of Ezekiel. We'll continue on next week. Thank you very much. Have a good day.